Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, the COVID-19 pandemic has not slowed home sales. In fact, it seems to have helped heat them up.
Last year's market was tepid compared to the current superheated housing market. Inventory is way down and prices are up.
Contributor Eileen Dalabrida offers a closer look at the state of Delaware's housing market. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn more about job training efforts to help those left unemployed by the COVID pandemic. Arts Playlist looks at the latest exhibition at the historic Odessa Foundation. And Enlighten Me examines pet adoption during the pandemic. It's all next here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. 1 year ago on The Green, just before the COVID pandemic lockdowns began, we reported that the housing market in Delaware was picking up significantly, with people selling a house in the first few months of 2020, often having their choice of offers. 1 year later, despite the pandemic, the story remains the same. If anything, the market is even hotter. This week, contributor Eileen Dalabrida examined the state of Delaware's housing market and what's driving it in her latest piece at DelawarePublic.org. And she joined me earlier this week to delve into the details. So as I mentioned, we were talking about this hot market a year ago pre-COVID. Is it actually even hotter now? What's it like right now?
Well, last year's market was tepid compared to the current superheated housing market. Inventory is way down, 43% less than this time last year, and prices are up more than 13% in Newcastle County.
So is inventory really the main factor that's driving this seller's market? Tell me a little bit more about it, the inventory piece of this.
It's a simple matter of supply and demand. Lots of buyers and not enough sellers, but the reasons behind that are more complex. People have been staying home for more than a year, plenty of time to figure out what they don't like about their homes, and many of them want more space so they can be comfortable working and entertaining themselves at home. At the same time, baby boomers, the folks who create inventory when they put their homes in the market, are staying on the sidelines until they believe it's safe to open their homes to potential buyers. And other potential sellers are staying put because they believe there's no place for them to go when they do sell.
And so what does all that mean for prices? Like, how big are sellers winning in this market?
Selling for above the listing price has become the norm. We're talking tens of thousands of dollars. Plus, buyers are waiving home inspections. Sometimes they're ponying up for real estate commissions and transfer taxes, which are 4% in Delaware. These are hefty expenses above and beyond paying more than listing price.
And those prices that are being offered above, you know, asking price are creating some sellers that maybe we might not normally see. Can you give us some examples of people who are kind of like looking at this market and saying, like, this is the right time for me to make this move?
Oh, for some sellers, it's a great opportunity. For people who are planning to retire to their vacation homes, selling at the top of the market means their nest eggs just got a lot bigger. It's also easing the pain for sellers in distress because of the pandemic. A couple in Kent County whose small business went under sold their house for a tidy profit, and now they have a cushion as they rent and they're rebuilding their finances. In Sussex, the owner of a bed and breakfast inn at the beach, who got clobbered when folks stopped traveling, sold for top dollar to a developer. And in Newcastle County, a landlord who got dinged because his tenants were financially impacted by the pandemic and couldn't pay got out of the rental business. He sold two townhomes.
Really interesting. And as you mentioned, you know, The downside for those looking to move is that while you may have no trouble selling your house, buying your next home may be a real challenge. And your story notes that people just may not get what they had hoped for. Compromising on your wish list is pretty much the norm right now, right?
Buyers are making compromises, great and small. People are more willing to roll up their sleeves and renovate kitchens and baths and give up niceties like hardwood floors. A single dad with two young children in Sussex County had to completely tear up his wish list just to find something within his $225,000 budget. He started looking for a house in good shape with a garage in Millsboro or Georgetown where he works. He wound up with a long commute, buying a fixer-upper in Seaford, and he'll have to build that garage later.
And so what are some of the other things that buyers, you know, have to do to win bidding wars? And I guess, like, how competitive are these bidding wars at this point in terms of if you see a house you like, how quickly do you have to move in, and what do you have to do to try and beat out the competition?
They're still doing things like writing heartfelt letters to the sellers, although the sellers tell me that a nice letter is not going to trump more money. And buyers are making much larger down payments and paying cash whenever they can because sellers want a smooth transition without any hassles regarding financing or appraisals. And I came across two very entrepreneurial buyers who clinched the deal by agreeing to buy the contents of the homes. One seller was concerned about the cost and hassle involved in storing his things while he looked for another home. And the other was with the heirs of an estate who were eager to avoid the time and energy involved in clearing out the house. The buyer just said, take what you want, and I will deal with the rest.
Just listening to what you had to say there, it came to me. Is this mean the market is really, really tough on first-time home buyers who may be doing an FHA loan, may not have the money for a down payment, all those kind of things that seem to be what you need at this point to have a leg up?
It's exceptionally difficult for first-time buyers. Not only do they have to pay more than they had anticipated for a property, but not having that big down payment, that rock-solid financing, does put them down the pecking order.
You mentioned Sussex County a couple of moments ago. Is the market the same at the beaches? Is this a phenomenon that's playing out there as well?
The vacation home market is very hot, and some buyers are bidding $1 million or more on properties based on video, just buying sight unseen. People want a place to chill that doesn't involve getting on a plane. And plus, they can spend more time now at their second home because many of them can work remotely.
So if you'd asked people a year ago, Eileen, I'm betting most would have said that COVID would hurt the housing market, that it would kind of cool things down. But your piece notes that it seems to have had a role in fueling it. You kind of alluded to it there, that people can work from home more now. What are some of the other ways that COVID is actually heating up this market instead of tamping it down?
But we have families who are bursting at the seams. Mom and dad are working from home. Kids are learning remotely. And on the other hand, we have people who ordinarily would be selling, wanting to stay put and ride this thing out. As for the bidding wars and rising prices, many people who have continued to work actually have extra money to spend. They aren't traveling. They aren't eating out. One couple took the money they would have spent on a big formal wedding and put it into a house.
Fascinating. It really is. And while we're talking about COVID's impacts on this housing market, what's the buying and selling experience been like during the pandemic? How has that kind of shifted just the mechanics and the logistics of buying a home?
It's all business, social distance style. There's no kicking of the tires. There's no thinking about it. The agent and the buyers drive to the home separately. They put on their masks and they take a quick walkthrough. Mom and dad can't come. Your best friend can't come. Just the buyers. And then there are safety protocols in space. If you want to look in a closet, the agent will open the door for you, close the door, and then wipe it down with a disinfectant afterward.
And one of the things you mentioned in the piece that I thought was fascinating was because there's so much interest, like so many people want to buy and there's such low inventory, that the amount of time you could spend looking at a house is shrinking as well. Like normally you would be, you know, you could probably go in there, wander around, maybe, oh, let me go back to that room and take a look again. That's not something you can really do right now, right?
Yeah, there were so many people who wanted to see a really nice house in Magnolia. It had a finished basement, updated baths, that coveted open concept kitchen, and they were just going to open it for one weekend. And so many folks wanted to look at it that they reduced the showing times from 45 minutes to 15.
But can you really look at a house in 15 minutes and make a decision to buy it?
Well, 33 people said yes.
That's amazing. That just blows my mind. So let's kind of get down to like the final look at this thing and you know, how long can this last? I mean, how far can this go before it actually cools off a bit?
Well, nobody knows for sure. We can't look into a crystal ball and see, but like COVID, it will subside eventually, although we don't know when. Real estate professionals, they expect that things will level off when sellers feel it's safe to list their homes. And when supply meets demand, it makes sense that some of the air has to come out of the market.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dalabrida for her time on The Green this week. Her piece on Delaware's housing market is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. Next, we learn about how a job training program created with COVID relief funding is working to help get some Delawareans back to work. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. A year into the COVID-19 pandemic, we are starting to see how some efforts to help people hit hard economically are faring. One example is Forward Delaware, a broad training program to help people laid off during the pandemic pivot to a new career. It wraps up this month, and in his latest piece, available at DelawarePublic.org, contributor Larry Nagengast looks at what it has been able to accomplish since it rolled out in August. And Larry joined me earlier this week to walk us through what he found. So let's start with the broad strokes. What is Forward Delaware? How did it get started? And what's its basic mission?
Okay, well, Forward Delaware is a free job training program started by the state by using more than $15 million in funds from the Federal CARES Act. And that's the COVID-19 relief legislation that was passed by Congress last year. Governor Carney set the program in motion last August when he signed his Executive Order 43. That order cited two significant issues concerning the pandemic and the state's labor force. First, the pandemic caused significant layoffs in key sectors of the state's economy, especially in the hospitality and retail areas. And the pandemic also created employment needs in other areas, especially in healthcare.
And exactly how big is the need for this in Delaware since the pandemic started? Do we have a sense of what the need actually is?
Well, sure. I mean, if you remember, go back to last May, which was just 2 months after the governor declared that state of emergency. And at that point, the state's unemployment rate peaked at 15.9%, which means that one out of every six Delawareans in the labor market was actually out of work. And there was a lot of pessimism then about when, if ever, those unemployed individuals might return to their former jobs. Situations like this can cause some people to despair, but they can also cause many people to think about their careers. Now, from the state's perspective, the situation did actually create an opportunity. They could use federal money to provide new skills to people whose old jobs just might not come back. And the state also looked at employment sectors where there were significant needs and or better opportunities for higher pay and advancement than might exist in those retail and hospitality sectors that were hardest hit at the start by the pandemic.
And it seems from your story that a large part of the efforts of this program have focused on IT. How did that piece of this program work?
Yeah, okay. Well, nearly $5 million, about 30% of that total CARES Act package for job retraining, was devoted to the information technology sector. And there were a couple of reasons for that. I mean, first of all, the state's financial sector, you know, the credit cards, the banking, and all that goes along with it, continues to grow, and it has had a steady demand for additional workers. Also, computers are an essential piece of equipment in just about every workplace. You can be a landscaping business, for instance, and you're going to need computers to keep track of your billing, your job assignments, and you know, just about everything else. So no matter what your business is, there's probably some sort of need for computers, and that means that there's always going to be a need for troubleshooters, help desk operators, and the like. So the way the program worked in IT, and it followed the same pattern in the other targeted employment areas, was the state contracted with a nonprofit organization called Tech Impact to actually run this training program. Now, Tech Impact did some of the training itself, and it also subcontracted a lot of this training work out to other partners, including established training programs like Zip Code Wilmington, Code Differently, the Precisionists, and several higher education institutions.
And with that last bit in mind, it was pretty easy to ramp this up because there was no need to kind of reinvent the wheel with this, right?
Right, exactly. Each of these partnering organizations has a regular training program going on. So some of the participants that were identified through Forward Delaware filled open spots in these ongoing classes. In other cases, the trainers were able to bump up their programs, adding new class sections or making existing classes larger. None of the providers had to start from scratch. All they had to do was do more and serve more people than they had been doing all along.
So how about some of the other targeted areas that you mentioned? You noted in your story that the program seems to have found connections between HR skills and the hospitality industry, for example.
Yes. Well, now the other areas of focus were healthcare, construction, transportation and logistics, and hospitality. Now, hospitality at first seems like an odd choice because that was one of these employment sectors that was hit hardest at the start of the pandemic. And indeed, it is still struggling to recover. But the pandemic did expose a significant problem, especially within the restaurant industry. What happened here was that as restaurant owners started to deal with these issues, laying off many workers, reducing hours for others, they suddenly had to pay a lot of attention to labor laws, to unemployment rules, all these things like along those lines. And there were a lot of places that realized that they didn't have anyone on their payroll who was skilled in these issues. And it's not uncommon for a restaurant, for example, to promote someone who had been on their staff for a while into that HR position. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they've had a lot of training in the details of doing that kind of work. So anyhow, through Forward Delaware, the Delaware Restaurant Association and the University of Delaware came up with a solution. UD adapted a hospitality human resources management class that is already being offered in its Lerner College of Business and Economics, and the business faculty from Lerner handled the instruction. The Restaurant Association identified 60 unemployed or underemployed restaurant workers to take the class. So it's a case here of a partnership identifying those who could benefit from the training and the university collaborating to fill that need.
I also found it interesting that this program was addressing some things that we've been hearing about recently in the news, targeting things like high turnover in nursing homes during the pandemic and the state's growing logistics opportunities.
Yeah. Well, as Forward Delaware was being developed, The governor directed the Department of Labor to work with the state's Workforce Development Board, whose members include a wide range of business leaders, to determine which employment areas made the most sense to be included in the program. The idea here was to focus on training in sectors that would have the potential for higher pay, for increased job security, and for more career advancement than the laid-off workers previously had in retail and hospitality or wherever else they might have been working. It was also important to create opportunities in a range of employment areas. I mean, face it, everybody's not interested in IT or healthcare, for example. And, you know, there are, certainly are many people who have an aptitude or an interest in working in the building trades, driving a truck, doing things like that. So it was an idea of broadening the training opportunities and making them more interesting and potentially more valuable for the people who had been laid off.
Now we often hear about Delaware Tech's involvement when we hear about programs like this, initiatives like this, but Delaware State University was also a part of this. How was DSU involved?
Well, you know, over the years, as you indicate, Delaware Tech has gained a well-deserved reputation as being essentially the go-to destination for people who are looking for career training. But other institutions of higher education, including Wilmington University, UD, and Delaware State, do offer certificate programs for adults who are looking to enhance their job skills or to enter new lines of work. Now, Delaware State's situation as it relates to IT is somewhat unique. In addition to working with Tech Impact on the Forward Delaware training, the school has also received a four-year, $9.2 million grant to train about 700 new IT workers. And the goal here is to increase the participation of racial and ethnic minorities in this rapidly growing field. So what's going to happen here is that Tech Impact will be working with Delaware State in developing the program. That's going to start sometime next month. And the training is going to include about 325 hours of instruction, covering things like working on support desks, computer coding, application development, cybersecurity, and a number of other topics that are related to the IT field.
So some of this is now starting to wind down a bit. Is there any sense of how well it's doing with helping participants get a job? And is this likely to kind of continue as the pandemic starts to wind down as well?
Okay. It's too soon to have definitive numbers. Some of the programs won't wrap up until the end of the month, and it may take a couple of months for some of the trainees to find jobs. But we do know that about 30% of the 250 trainees in information technology have already found work, and that nursing homes and assisted living facilities have been filling vacancies with people who had completed the training as certified nursing assistants. As for the future of Forward Delaware, that's not entirely clear. The current program is winding down because CARES Act funds have to be spent by the end of March. Governor Carney's office has not announced whether the state will use any of its $1.25 billion share of the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan passed earlier this month on these new job training programs. But the governor does say that the state's ability to rebound from the pandemic will rely in part on providing rapid retraining for the people who need it so that they can qualify for jobs that are in high demand. Now, also, the officials at the State Department of Labor say that they expect to use their regular mix of state and federal funds to continue offering some form of training in these targeted employment sectors. So as we know that the organizations that have been providing the training say they're ready and able also to continue what they've been doing. So what's the bottom line here? Basically, expect the state to continue with these rapid retraining initiatives, but we really can't say yet how extensive these training programs are going to be in the future, and we can't say for certain how they're going to be funded.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week. His piece on Forward Delaware and job training for those who lost work during the pandemic is available at DelawarePublic.org. And the Green continues next with Arts Playlist and more on the historic Odessa Foundation's first exhibition of 2021. You're listening to The Green here on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. There's still a little time to check out the historic Odessa Foundation's first exhibition of the year. Our Delaware, which features 27 assorted works from the personal collections of Foundation staff members, is up for one more week. It includes everything from prints and etchings to oils on canvas. In this week's Arts Playlist, the Foundation's assistant curator, Brian Miller, speaks with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about how it all came together.
Hey, let's talk about this new exhibit. It's already underway. It's the first exhibit of 2021. It's a special art exhibit. What's the name of it?
Right. The title is Our Delaware, Local Art Collected by the Historic Odessa Foundation Staff.
Well, I'm intrigued just by that. Tell me all about it.
In March, we have a little bit lower attendance, so we thought, oh, what a perfect timing to have the local staff, and since everything is pretty much local now with the pandemic, we thought it'd be a really good opportunity to show what the staff at the museum has collected over the years. So I invited all of the staff to submit 1 to 3 works of art that we're either Delaware artists or Delaware paintings, like, you know, say Delaware landscapes or scenes. And we had 7 out of our 10 staff members participate. So I'm really happy with that. And we have, you know, artists that are pretty well known in the state, and we have scenes that are, you know, pretty well known in the state. So it's come out to be a really nice little exhibit.
Talk about some of those artists who are pretty well known and about their works. What can we expect to see when we visit?
Okay, sure. There's some Robert Shaw etchings. He was a very early engraver and artist in Wilmington, Delaware. So we have one of the Old Swedes Church, and we have one of a scene in Wilmington. We have more contemporary artists such as James McGlynn, and it's really nice. One of the collectors has, you know, lent this work, and it's of the Corbett Sharp House. So that's even more interesting, you know, a local scene right in Odessa. There's Jack Lewis, you know, well-known artist from Bridgeville and worked in Dover on the Green a lot. We have lots of female artists, Jeanette Slocum Edwards, well-known for her watercolors from Wilmington. We have, let's see, I'm trying to think who else, other artists. We have William Hank Smallwood from Dover. So we're pretty much having every county represented, and male and female, living and artists. Let's see, one other that I'd like to mention is we have Laura Hickman from Bethany Beach. So, you know, it's a really wide variety, everything from prints to etchings to watercolors to oils on canvas. So, you know, it's a very nice exhibit.
This sounds like a fantastic exhibit. We are talking to the assistant curator for the Historic Odessa Foundation, Mr. Brian Miller. The first exhibit of this year, 2021, is titled Our Delaware. And, you know, Our Delaware comes from the official Delaware State song written as a poem. Can you give us some background about that, Brian?
Sure. When I was coming up with a title, I thought, you know, again, things being local, you know, these are our collection, our museum, our, you know, so it's like, then I thought, oh my gosh, I know that our state song, which is little known, I think, and not used really that often, you know, it became our official song in 1925, written originally as a poem by George Hinson, if I'm saying his last name correctly. And then it was adapted into music by Will Brown, and it, you know, became the official song. So I thought, well, this would be a good chance to showcase not only that song as the title, but then, you know, the works as well. And maybe some people are not as familiar with the artist. So, you know, it kind of lends itself to, you know, new audiences for not only the title, but then the works and the artists.
Brian, how has the Historic Odessa Foundation fared during the pandemic? We'll start with that question. I have a follow-up question.
Oh, sure. If you're talking financially or something like that, I wouldn't be prepared to really to talk about that. We would talk with our director, but I would say we've fared pretty well. We've pretty much been open, at least as far as one building. We haven't been able to give personal, you know, guided tours like we usually do of our historic homes. But our Cantwell's Tavern restaurant has been doing very well, and that obviously supports the museum. Obviously, we're down in income from walk-in visitors and you know, events and things like that. We, you know, are really disappointed last year. Our major event every year for the last, I think, 6-7 years has been our annual Brewfest in September. So we're unable to have that due to COVID. But, you know, we're preparing for the new year and hoping that things will get to open up, and we're prepared to, you know, start fresh and, you know, have a great season.
Yeah, with this new exhibit, the first exhibit of 2021 called Our Delaware, are safety protocols still in place for this?
Yes. You can walk in, but, you know, we obviously have a limit to how many can look around in the gallery space at the visitor center. And you do need to wear your mask. And, you know, we recommend, you know, obviously staying 6 feet apart from other groups. So, you know, it's all the same things that we've had for the last year. But, you know, again, we're really happy to have at least our visitor center open. It gives our presence in the town and community. And with people still visiting the Cantwell's Tavern, you know, they stop in there, you know, if they're waiting for a table or they're, you know, taking a look around. So, you know, we've been pleased that, you know, it's been a fair attendance over the last year.
Just reminding people again, we're talking with the assistant curator of the Historic Odessa Foundation, Brian Miller. Brian, what else do you guys have planned for this year? Anything exciting?
We have more exhibits planned in our space. We're changing every 2 months. We hope to bring our children's events back. We're having an Easter egg hunt on Palm Sunday. We're bringing back our Christmas exhibit. You know, annually for the last 35 years, we've showcased scenes from children's literature, from classic literature. So we hope to have that back. So we're in the planning process for that. We can't announce necessarily our theme yet, but we'll probably have that out in a few months. And again, you know, like most museums in our state and our Mid-Atlantic area, we're, you know, just basically waiting to see how this COVID is going to pan out and how the pandemic is going to subside, hopefully, with everyone getting their, you know, shots and everything. So we're ready for, you know, another exciting year at Odessa.
What makes the Historic Odessa Foundation so great, so special?
Well, because of the great 18th century and early 19th century historic houses, all on the National Historic Register, the Corbett Sharp House on the which is a National Historic Landmark, also part of the National Network to Freedom site, you know, part of the Underground Railroad. Just a you know, charming community right along the Appaquinimic River, great history and such a diverse collection of buildings and decorative arts and, you know, just this really special place in Delaware to visit.
How long is the new exhibit on display?
Sure. This exhibit will go until March 28th. And then over the weekend, it will change. We'll be excited to have a April exhibit, which is going to be our annual exhibit of the local high school students from Middletown High School. They showcase their advanced placement studio art. So typically there's 5 to 10 students who then use our space. They have a collection of their work, and they show it before they're going to submit it in May to be judged and scored, so that they could possibly receive credit for art classes, going off to college. So, it's a really nice event, and really, again, a nice local event. Typically, we have a reception, which we'll be having, and, it will be really nice.
Thanks to Historic Odessa Foundation Assistant Curator Brian Miller and R. Kelly Steele for joining us on this week's Arts Playlist. More information on the Historic Odessa Foundation and its exhibitions can be found at historicodessa.org. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me and a look at pet adoption during the pandemic. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The year-old COVID-19 pandemic turned more Delawareans into pet owners, or in some cases, repeat pet owners. Pet adoptions are increasing as more people spend time at home. And in this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media contributor Mark Fowler reports the interest in adopting a shelter pet is growing at a good time as local shelters start taking in more endangered dogs and cats from states a time zone away.
A plane comes in for a landing at Delaware Coastal Airport in Georgetown, carrying very precious cargo. Nearly 90 dogs rescued from a troubled shelter in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. The shelter was left a wreck after a recent winter storm. But caring for pets from other states is nothing new for the Brandywine Valley SPCA. Lauren Cook is operations manager at its Newcastle shelter. She says some states have more relaxed rules regarding spay and neuter, and shelters can easily get overwhelmed.
Some places don't have the resources available to do spay and neuter for all their shelter animals that they're adopting out, or even animals in the public. And a lot of times in those areas, people don't have the resources themselves to spay and neuter their own pets. So, I think that definitely plays a role in that.
The Brandywine Valley SPCA works with an organization known as Wings of Rescue. Cook says there is usually several days' notice of a rescue flight.
Basically, our team gets ready during the week, make sure, we know which dogs are going to which campus, have the kennels ready for them. We send staff and volunteers to the airport to unload the animals, and then they come to the shelter here to get their medical exams. All the pets that come in get a medical exam within 8 hours. We evaluate them. If they're ready for adoption, then they usually go up for adoption the next day.
The BVSPCA even has a team currently working at a shelter in Louisiana on educating the local community about the importance of spay and neuter and shelter pet adoption. At the Delaware Humane Association,
We're in our dog adoption area.
Executive Director Patrick Carroll says it's also been taking in rescue pets from other states that arrive on flights that land in New Jersey. DHA has already been working with shelters in North Carolina and West Virginia. The Wilmington location has space for about 50 dogs and 100 cats, but Carroll says they tend to be adopted quickly.
It's like a supply and demand issue. There's a lot of dogs and cats in the South who are homeless or they've been stray and they got out. It's not enough homes, but up here there aren't as many strays and there aren't, the reality is there's a lot of homes, people looking to adopt.
Linda Changlini of Newark was looking to adopt even during a very difficult year, a year in which she lost her mother and two good friends, one due to COVID-19, and she recently had to put down one of her dogs. Days after a friend died in February, Faithful Friends called her about an application she had on file.
And she told me she had this little dog, and if I was interested, and that they'd be closing at 7 o'clock. And it was 6 o'clock when she called me. She sent me a little photo of the dog. Without knowing her story, I just looked at her and I said, I have to have her. Wait there, I'll be right there.
And she was. Changlini came home with Skylar, who had arrived from Arkansas.
To just give them a new life and to give them and show them love, it's such a wonderful, rewarding feeling.
Faithful Friends also recently accepted 10 dogs from a storm-damaged shelter in Texas. They tend to get adopted quickly, thanks to people like David Kolonowski of Downingtown, Pennsylvania. His family had dogs in the past, but with grown children now and a pandemic developing, he and his wife, Lynn, got to thinking.
We were kind of like back to, okay, we can't really travel, we can't go anywhere, but yet it's kind of just empty here in our house because we don't have, you know, we don't have a dog.
They learned about Doc McDoggins, who underwent two surgeries resulting from being hit apparently by a car. They started off fostering her, but ultimately adopted her, and they now call her Gracie.
You know, I can only imagine what it was like for her on the street, having to fight for all her food and not trusting people because they were, you know, who knows, they were maybe abusing her. And so she didn't trust people. And to see those walls come down as, you know, we're just caring for her and loving her and taking her for walks and, you know, doing everything we do with, you know, the dogs we've had in the past.
Gary DeVito of Bear ended up adopting two cats from the SPCA about 2 months ago. He has fostered cats in the past, but he's learned a lot from these two.
Patience. These two cats have really taught me just to take it slow and be patient. Most of my other cats adjusted very well within a week or so. These two, it's really taken an extra amount of time, an extra amount of love, basically.
Delaware Humane's Patrick Carroll believes the pandemic encouraged many individuals and families who were suddenly spending more time at home to consider adopting a dog or cat. But he believes with many people, it goes deeper.
Where people are really looking at life and what's important and what's, you know, there are certain things that people are saying, I'm never going back to that. My life has changed now, right? So I think that's affected pets in a good way because people have said, you know, I've reflected and I've always wanted a cat and I'm getting one.
At the SPCA, Cook says adoptions were up about 20% since before the pandemic.
We'll have our flight animals ready on Saturday and by Wednesday they're all adopted, which is wonderful. So we're definitely up in numbers for our adoptions this year.
Pet adoption has evolved during the pandemic. More is done online with fewer in-person visits. Fundraising events have been scaled back. And despite volunteer hours being largely suspended, Carroll says DHA found itself taking part in about 15 pet food pantries.
If it just helps them, that gives them a little less. If they don't have to spend money on pet food, at least they have money to spend on other things that they need.
And shelters like the Delaware Humane, Faithful Friends, and the Brandywine Valley SPCA are there to help pet owners in other ways in an effort to keep pets with their owners long term, according to Carroll.
And so sometimes it might just be medical needs, some assistance with some veterinary issues or, you know, advice or just being talked off a ledge or some guidance or maybe landlord issues. So it doesn't always work, but at least now we're having that conversation about, well, what can we do to keep this animal with you?
But the Brandywine Valley SPCA's Lauren Cook reminds potential owners it's fine to be smitten with a dog or cat. Just make sure you think it through.
You're talking 15 to 20 years with this animal. You know, it's a financial investment as well. And we try to counsel all of our adopters on those things when they're taking the pets home. You know, we do have a partnership with a pet insurance company. So we try to set these folks up for success with their pet. But, you know, ultimately, you know, you need to make sure you're ready to bring this pet into your life. You know, have time to train it and socialize it and things like that.
And if you are comfortable with opening your home to a new pet, Linda Changlini says maybe, just maybe, consider more.
I never wanted to only have one dog. I usually have three little dogs at a time. This is my first time having two dogs. I'm still looking for another maybe.
In Newcastle, Mark Fauser, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks to contributor Mark Fauser for enlightening us this week. And that'll do it for this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Contributors Eileen Dalabrida, Mark Fauser, and Larry Nagengast. as well as Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.